Yammer Kevin Sakhar Velo. This is Tabeelpod.com, the week in Georgia in English, coming to you from our studios high atop Tbilisi's sunny and vernal Rustavelli Avenue. Today is Thursday, the 25th of April, 2013. On this date in 1507, geographer Martin Waldisemuller uses the name America for the first time. 1719, Robinson Crusoe is published. 1859, ground is broken for the Suez Canal. 1915, 78,000 Anzac troops land at Gallipoli. 1916, UK declares martial law in Ireland. 1933, the US and Canada dropped the gold standard. 1953, scientists identified DNA. 1966, the city of Tashkent is destroyed by an earthquake. 1974, Marcelo Castrano is overthrown in Portugal, creating the Carnation Revolution, the first flower revolution that I know of. 1980, Tehran hostage rescue mission fails. That's the one that the U.S. sponsored. 1982, Israel completes its withdrawal from the Sinai Peninsula as per the Camp David Accords. 1983, Andropov writes to an American fifth grader, Samantha Smith. And in 1993, Russia elects Boris Yeltsin leader. Birthdays today are Puritan cheerleader Oliver Cromwell, Ella Fitzgerald, Renee Zellweger, Imran Khan, and Edward R. Murrow. Today, it's just me, Mark Mullen, and Oliver Cromwell fan Will Dunbar on an extended sabbatical back in a grateful sum show blow. Our employers, past, present, and future, have direct and legal responsibility for anything and everything we say today. Thank you to those of you who posted on our forum with comments. We had a bunch of comments, a lot of questions for ministers, all sorts of good stuff. Several of those emailed as well. We're going to be starting our in ministerial interviews soon, so be sure to send in whatever you want. Great ones from Simon. Some kudos for Will, who kept his head during my witty belittlement of his views last week, allegedly. We had a question about work permits, which we will look into and see what we can find out. But keep the questions coming for the ministers. My Georgian Journal and Kvitis Politra column this week is about the U.S. and Chechnya and how Georgia is doing some very cool things, having so many, you know, having its borders open to so many different people, is becoming quite a hub, great for tourism, et cetera, et cetera. But watch border security, because particularly coming up to the Sochi Olympics, that will be important. On Tuesday, Prime Minister Bidzina Ivanishvili spoke in front of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe in Strasbourg, that highly important body. He said that because of Russian aggression towards Georgia, there's still a danger of war. He noted Russia has occupied 20% of Georgian territory since 2008. Prime Minister said he and his coalition aim to mend relations with Russia. When asked about his view on the reopening of the railway running through Abkhazia, which would link Russia with Georgia and Armenia, BI said that he was certain the railway would reopen. He was asked, quote, why the government didn't fully consider the recommendations from the Venice Commission during the implementation of the court reform, end quote. He replied that the opposition is disseminating lies and inaccurate information. Yeah, which was sort of a stupid comment. Like, what does that mean? Why didn't they fully obey the Venice Commission? What exactly was meant by that? Because, well, the court reform, frankly, is going pretty well. What's going to be vetoed or not is not
clear. I mean, the point is about the Venice Commission did say in its recommendations that there needs to be continuity, and according to the law, there won't be very much continuity. Only two members of the sitting higher council of justice were guaranteed to keep their jobs.
Okay, but there will be a lot of continuity for judges. There will not be continuity for the High Council of Justice, which seems quite reasonable for me, because considering that the courts were controlled by the prosecutors,
right,
and the High Council of Justice didn't do a heck of a lot about that.
Well, the High Council of Justice allowed it to happen, and that's a valid point. But the fact remains that the Venice Commission's concern here, which was not fully addressed by Bidzina, no matter what he says, and of course it's not a total, you know, travesty, and it's not completely ignoring the Venice Commission recommendations at all, as the head of the Venice Commission even said on that day. But the fact is that there will be this massive turnaround in the staffing of the Higher Council of Justice, and the Venice Commission rightly pointed out in its recommendations that even though the new system of staffing the council is better, having a big turnaround after every election, after every transfer of power, sets a very bad precedent, and yes, it does. And they suggested that there was some sort of transition mechanism which would allow more members of the HCOJ to keep their seats while the new system sort of gears up, and that was the one recommendation that was not followed by it in this new law. And the fact is, I mean, that's a good point. You can't just have these supposedly independent branches of government being totally cleaned out every time there's a change of power. But and it does set a precedent.
I totally disagree with that. I mean, look, the whole High Council of Justice, their purpose was to oversee the judiciary. And they failed completely. Now, I understand the logic that you don't want to have a complete turnover and something like this, but what really matters is the judges. And I think that, you know, frankly, the new team is being relatively magnanimous in saying that, you know, essentially all the judges can keep their positions, even considering that they were completely controlled by the prosecutors. Well, were pretty quiet about that.
If you look back on
what happened to the judges when the National Movement came in, it was pretty brutal. Now, some of them were corrupt. Maybe most of them were corrupt, but some of them were not. And the last few judges who'd been there for a long time, the way they were removed by saying that, okay, you know, you go now and you'll get a pension, and if not, you know, it's not going to go well for you, was pretty brutal. And so, well, now that the new government is more or less keeping the old judges and not calling for a complete turnaround, but, you know, getting rid of most of the High Council of Justice, you know, and having the National Movement say, well, that's not fair, you know, I mean, that seems to be, everybody knows that the judiciary was controlled by the prosecutors during that time, and they don't seem to be talking too much about that, you know?
Well, I'm going to have to disagree, because A, the judiciary was not controlled by the prosecutors, it was controlled by the High Council of Justice, and it was that system which allowed the prosecutors to exercise so much influence. The way it worked was as simple as, you have a judge in a sensitive case, and he goes the wrong way, and he'll find he won't be dismissed, but he'll find himself in Mestia or in Honi, your favourite. and that was the High Council of Justice, whose one of its main functions is disciplining judges, and it used that function to
disciplining to do what the prosecutors say, and these are the people that should
right,
stay there
precisely.
Now.
Precisely. Well, no, I mean the thing is, you know, we've got a new government, which promised to be less invasive into the process of justice, and that's a very good thing. However, having this massive turnaround sets a bad precedent. And what if they lose the election in 4 years' time? Are we going to have yet another reform of the Higher Council of Justice so the new guys that get in have it their way? This is just not a good way of doing things. And having a temporary mechanism was a perfectly sensible thing in my view. Now, it's not the end of the world, unlike Misha pretends it is, but it's still a valid point that they raise.
We'll have to agree to disagree on this because you're so incredibly wrong. But anyway, point taken. He replied that the opposition is disseminating lies and inaccurate information. When Polish MP Zinu Grzynski told BI, quote, "You don't like President Saakashvili, but I think you like the president of Russia, Mr. Putin, very much. Do you think Putin is responsible for ethnic cleansing in Georgia in 2008? Do you want to defend the independence of Georgia together with Mr. President Saakashvili?" End quote. BI responded that politics should not be based on personal affections, adding that, quote,
"You should take that to heart, by the way."
Yeah. if not for Misha's huge mistakes, it would have been very difficult for Russia to carry out this aggression, end quote. At a press conference afterwards, BI accused Rustavioti of misinforming European officials about his government's activities. He further claimed that... What European officials care what Rustavioti has to say about anything? He further claimed that Misha admitted at a closed meeting between the two of them that Rustavioti belonged to him. The president's administration denied BI's assertion that the president is the real owner of Rustavi too.
I mean, but the thing here was that Misha then released a statement condemning BI for not defending Georgia's territorial integrity to the hilt by, for instance, admitting that Georgia's made mistakes, which it palpably has, in its relations with the Abkhaz and the Ossetians. But it was quite funny to see these buddies of Saakashvili from the European People's Party sort of haranguing BI to try and get to say something, you know, silly or pro-Russian or whatever, and BI was sort of fastidious in not saying that, but did attack Saakashvili resolutely and throughout. And it is sort of a weird situation where he goes, yes, we're occupied 20%, but we've made loads of mistakes, and he refuses to attack the occupier, but will attack his cohabiting president. That does look a bit weird from the rostrum of the PACE, I think.
I mean, if you look at it from the point of view of the good of the nation, there are some very good reasons not to attack Russia, whereas, you know, attacking Saakashvili is a much easier shot. You know,
it's certainly an easier shot, but is it the right thing to do?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think that, you know, in terms of the right thing to do, that what he's, you know, what he says in terms of admitting mistakes is the right thing to do.
I agree
and saying
with that.
That, you know, saying, you know, that you're not defending Georgia's territorial integrity by saying that mistakes have been made with the Abkhaz and with South Ossetia, I think is, you know, that's really problematic.
I would agree with that, but at the same time, you know, one does have to be fairly clear about stating the fact that Russia has been incredibly aggressive. And,
well, he has. I mean, he was. He said, you know, he said that. He didn't use the, you know, the sort of.
He was slightly
language.
More mealy mouthed about it than he was about how bad Russia is. If you see what I mean.
All right, that's true. On Monday, NDI, the National Democratic Institute, published approval ratings done by CRRC of Georgian political parties. CRC conducted a poll with funding from CETA. I mean, NDI had funding from CETA, for which it contracted CRC to do the poll, which has all of those other polls. Sorry, a little, you know, convoluted there. 60% of respondents support the Georgian Dream Coalition. 10% support UNM. 4% said they support other parties. 11% said they support no party. 8% refused to answer. And 7% said they don't know. 62% of the respondents said that they would support the coalition if the elections were to be held the following day. 9% said that they would support UNM. 17% said they don't know. 6% refused to answer. 2% said that they would vote for none of the parties. So that's interesting. Certainly, I mean, the biggest change in all of that is the shrinking of the percentage of people who either said don't know or refused to answer. That was very close to 50% in the months before the election, and is now down to less than 20. You know, for those of you who followed this, NDI, you know, published the horse race numbers before the election, saying that the UNM was much more popular than Georgian Dream, but there was a very large portion of people who did not answer that I think we can now safely assume were afraid to answer the question. And there are many fewer people who are afraid to answer right now. Now there.
Also, there's not an election coming up, so people.
Right.
You know, so it's much easier to say, yeah, those guys are these guys, rather than actually
right.
have to go into the polling booth and make your mind up.
Yeah, exactly.
But what do we think? Is 10% a bad result for the UNM? Is it a disastrous result? Is it encouraging? What do we think?
Well, they've got a long way to, you know, go up from here. They're probably only going to become, you know, more popular, especially if
you
things
think this
get
is
together.
The lowest ebb.
Well, I think yes. I mean, I think that there's still people are still, you know, they've had a long enough time to sort of judge the Georgian Dream in power. You know, to see a lot of statements that they like or don't like. Obviously, there's now. At least for the time being, and let's hope it'll stay that way. There's plenty of media that is very, very critical of the government. You know, and by the same token, I think there seems to be a good chance, maybe not a likelihood, but a good chance that the national movement will, you know, will get it together and sort of decide who it is a little bit more effectively. Now, what needs to happen is the national movement needs to shake out and decide who has a place in it and who its faces are going to be and, you know, who's going to, you know, go be an emeritus professor somewhere and who's, you know, those sorts of questions. But yeah, I mean, I'd say why not?
So you think it's an encouragement? I mean, I tend to agree. I mean, it's obviously not what they want, but at the same time, it's not, you know, it doesn't seem like they're being totally eclipsed at the moment. I mean, I wonder what this means for their discussions about who's going to be their presidential candidate, because if I was a big-hitting national movement guy, I probably wouldn't want to stand in the forthcoming elections because you don't want to be a loser. And one of the other interesting things about the results of that poll is how popular Dato Bakradze, the former Speaker of Parliament and current minority leader in Parliament, how popular he is vis-a-vis the other leaders. So he's got a popularity rating of around 48%, which is by far the highest in the UNM. And he's got this reputation for being a sort of reasonable man, not a sort of blowhard. Is he a potential future presidential candidate, or is he a bit too grey? I mean, I don't know, but...
Yeah, I mean, he was, you know, he's well-spoken, and he's a smart guy. He did not control Parliament during the time that he was the Speaker of Parliament. I mean, that was other people telling him what to do and amending the Constitution so that, you know, 20, 2-year-old, you know, Nashas could be members of parliament, all those sorts of things. But he seems to be playing a very positive role right now, and so I think that gets to one of the big questions of Georgian politics and maybe even Georgian culture is how important is strength? You know, generally, you know, Georgians have respected strong men. A lot of discussion about, you know, Stalin, you know, having a bit of a resurgence. Misha is certainly a decisive individual. You know, the Okhrushvili was, you know, very, you know, popular for a while and was sort of the tough guy. But you know, the fact that Dato Bakradze is not a tough guy.
And Usupashvili is the current Speaker of Parliament, is also enjoys enormously popular.
Right, rating. And they're not tough guys. They're smart and they're conciliatory. Yeah. They're, you know, they play the long game, and that, you know, maybe that's showing some sort of change that the Georgian public has, you know, maybe had it a little bit with the tough guys. The hardest working NGO in the Caucasus, TI Georgia, published a report which says that businessmen transferred a total of 152 million lari to the state as gifts over the last 3 years. Many businessmen have publicly stated that the former government forced, pressured, and intimidated them into giving these gifts. No need to go into details here, but some of the individual gifts are worth millions and seem pretty obviously coerced. Check this story to see where it ends up going in terms of prosecutions. I very much recommend taking a look at transparency.ge to look at the report and see some of the gifts that were given.
One of the things I was interested in about this is not the large gifts, and everyone's heard those stories about, and it now appears that they're completely true, about businessmen being pressured to give their entire fortunes in some cases to the former government. But what I was particularly interested in was the little gifts, the gifts of little parcels of land worth maybe $1,000 and stuff up and down the country. You know, these little tiny gifts which aren't from big businessmen, but which were just from regular Joes. And you sort of think about the backlash against the national movement, you think about their crushing defeat in October, and no one, you know, you also think about, you know, the mentality here. And really, people don't really care if some rich guy gets sat on by the government. But little guys up and down the country, small businessmen, farmers, etc., being forced to give a little of what they have and they don't have very much, I mean, that's a huge source of resentment. And that's coming out of the woodwork now. And it'd be very interesting to see sort of how that gets resolved in terms of both prosecutions and what the national movement has to say about it.
And it's also tough to deal with, you know, just how many of these things are they going to go through and for how long? You know, they've talked about a Truth and Reconciliation Commission or something like that. You know, there's a lot of, you know, do they send these through the courts that were the same courts that allowed this to happen before? And it's, you know, are they just going to do the big cases? Are they just going to do them for, you know, no more than 2 years? Or how do they do this? It's quite a complicated question. There's some real worries that this could completely gum up the courts just dealing with just all of, you know, these
well,
sort of
it
things.
Doesn't, it doesn't just gum up the courts. I mean, more importantly, it takes up a huge amount of political capital and time and just bother from part of the new government who, let's face it, have a country to run as well as just dealing with the past.
And their own gifts to coerce. Or let's hope that doesn't happen. No story so far. Following up on last week's story, last Thursday, Otsneva MP Yanina Imedelashvili released formerly classified documents from the Special State Protection Service accounting records. These documents show that Misha spent public money on personal expenses, gifts, and lavish trips with public officials.
And also his education of his children.
Indeed. One document shows that €37,500 was spent on the president's 5-day stay at a spa resort in Italy's South Tyrol in February 2011, where Misha stayed with Gia Baramidze, State Minister of Euro-Atlantic Integration, and Gheorghe Ervaladze, who then ran Imedi TV. 5,900 lari was transferred to Misha's youngest son, Nicolos's primary school. 24,000 lari was transferred to his oldest son, Edward's school, Gazat, in 2010 and 11. Another document shows that 115,000 lari was spent when Misha and Tbilisi Mayor Gigi Ugolava stayed for a week at the Park Hotel Health Spa in Austria in October 2010. Lots of spas. In December 2011...
That's why he's got such lovely skin.
Yeah. In December 2011, documents show that a bracelet worth 3,500 lari was bought with SSPS funds and given to Mariam Sajaya, who's now a UNM lawmaker. Sajaya is 22 and is the youngest member of parliament. Also, Misha bought 1,600 lari mobile phone for the UNM parliamentary MP Tina Bokuchava. Later, Misha downplayed the allegations of misusing public funds, saying, quote, tell me even one country in the world where the president is not making foreign trips, not staying, not taking with him parliamentarians, government members, and also family members, and is not inviting guests to the country for the purposes of popularizing their own country, end quote. Misha added that these efforts helped him attract investments.
I mean, okay, so I think a couple of things about this. So, first of all, I wonder how much of this is just, you know, really poor accounting and how much of this is genuinely sort of vaguely legitimate, just like Misha says. You know, you do need to give gifts, you do need to take people to expensive hotels sometimes. I mean, sure, that's, you know, I can see how that could be legitimate. The stuff about the school, on the other hand, and the golden bracelets and stuff, absolutely not. And the interesting thing here is that this is probably the biggest smoking gun we have in terms of corruption, allegations of corruption against the very highest officials in the former government. And it's not elite corruption, which we were all talking about back in the day. Everyone was, before the election, everyone goes, ooh, the elite corruption, and you sort of assume that he's got a slice of the gold mine, or he's got a slice of the oil pipeline, or he's got some billion-dollar investment through some offshore company or something like that. But it's not. It's petty corruption. It's exactly the thing that Misha was so proud to having stamped out. It's petty. It's like a few hundred, it's a few thousand here, it's a few thousand there, it's a nice mobile phone, it's a gold necklace. It's no, it isn't a slice of the copper mine. Well, it's just a load of...
Yes and no. I mean, I would not say that when you talk about grand corruption that everybody presumed that Misha had slices of the gold mine or whatever else. I mean, I think that what people meant by that, and what a lot of national movement people say, is that, oh, individuals didn't get a bunch of money, didn't have a bunch of money. It was all for the party. And the party did hoover up a pile of money. And
as
so,
discussed.
And so, as discussed. So, you know, I don't know. There's certainly a lot of stories about, you know, certain individuals, let's say Gigi Ugulava, just making piles of money himself, you know, one way or another.
Through construction companies.
Through construction companies, what, you know, whatever else. But I think, you know, you can have grand corruption that is either for the party or is just sort of state, you know, the state pushing around businesses or whatever else, and theoretically at least not having, you know, very senior officials get rich. When you're talking about petty corruption, I think what the national movement did do a great job at dealing with was just the sort of the payment for transactions that regular Georgians had to deal with constantly.
Through
their life. Absolutely, and that petty corruption really did end.
But it's very interesting that Misha outlawed petty corruption for everyone but himself.
Right, exactly. And that was misuse. That was, you know, misuse of state funds for, you know, ridiculous, silly, petty little things that came about as a you know, from a lack of transparency, essentially, with these, you know,
a lack of investigative reporting, which was deliberate, a lack of a total lockdown on
communications. So one of the, you know, there's a lot of disadvantages of having a billionaire as the head of state or prime minister, you know, which is that it attracts a lot of, you know, losers that want his money and all of that. But one big advantage it has is that, you know,
he probably doesn't have his fingers in the till.
Exactly.
It's a very small till. It's very big fingers. You know,
he's not going to worry about, you know, who, you know, getting the government to pay for, you know, his kids' tuition. And so, you know, it would be nice if this opportunity were used to set up procedures so that for future heads of state, you know, that might not have billions, let's hope, you know, those procedures will be in place to prevent that from happening. On Friday, UNM drew over 10,000 supporters in front of Parliament Building in Tbilisi. The rally was to defend Georgia's pro-Western foreign policy course, which BI's government supposedly threatens. Leaders spoke of the party's renewal and launched a new campaign, which they dubbed the New National Movement. UNM MP.
It's a little bit complicated. They use a different word for national here.
Oh, right? Yeah?
Yeah, so before, they were called the Natsnyaruri, which is just a straight-up translation from the English. And so now they're sort of, I mean, I'm not sure if it's an official rebranding, I didn't quite get the nuance there, but they're a vague rebranding as the Erovnuli, which is the Georgian word for national movement,
okay.
Which in the Erovnuli Brzroba was the name for the national movement in the 80s, the National Liberation Movement.
Uh-huh.
And so they're sort of going on the coattails of that. But as an aside, my favourite thing about the rally was Tamara Chergereshvili, editor-in-chief of Tabula magazine and wife of Giga Bakaria, an all-round cool woman, but in a certain libertarian sense, when she was asked what she was doing at the rally by Jen, she said, well, I'm here because I'm an Armenian homosexual. and I thought that was very, very good.
So listen, smart Georgian linguist, knowledgeable people that happen to be listening here, post on our forum about the, you know, reading the runes on the, you know, the language here and what that means, because that's quite important. UNMMP Gheorghe Vashadze, who acted as the MC at the rally, said the UNMMP...
Tamada, perhaps? I mean, do the rallies have Tamada?
MC Tamada, Medikipe. Said that UNM's new campaign will be based on three principles. Freedom of a united Georgian state, personal and economic liberty, got the libertarianism thing in there, and a new vision of Georgia's role and capabilities in the globalized world. Whatever that means. Senior UNM people repeated the message of renewal, saying that the party is now different and that it has learned lessons from its past mistakes. So let's not talk about those anymore. For those who don't know, the national movement is usually associated with a mass independence movement that unfolded in Georgia in the 80s against the Soviet rule, as Will just said. By the way, according to Interpress News, Medabashvili did not listen to Misha's speech and left the rally during the speech.
And then said, when he was asked about it, goes, oh, no, Misha is my best friend. No.
Yeah, that's, I mean, the relationship between Medabashvili and Misha is very important. Nobody really knows much about it. I mean, there's lots of talk about who's going to stay in the UNM, who's going to be important. They're looking for new faces. They've decided Vashadze is a new face. You know, there could be others in there. There's certainly an important group in parliament, which has been, you know, people like Dato Bakradze, but also, you know, Palico and Kubalashvili and some others. You know, where are they going to be? Chiora, where are they? The sort of parliamentary group, like, you know, let's be independent parliamentarians, you know, sort of figuring out a way to pass some laws and fix Georgia. You know, there's the party of no, sort of the American Republican leadership equivalent within the UNM, which I think that Misha, you know, seems to be, you know, going essentially according to that plan. And, you know, and then there's people just really do not like the Achalayas. There's some, you know, there's a lot of others connected, particularly not necessarily with Medabashvili, but, you know, I would say, you know, Shashkin doesn't seem to be a particularly popular guy, you know, in that group. And so where are they going to, you know, to end up in all of this? And that'll be an important thing to watch. But it seems to me that the key relationship is Vano and Misha.
But I mean, so 10,000 people, not too bad. You know, not great. I mean, they must have been hoping for more. But it was, I mean, if you read the Georgian press, you'd have seen for weeks in advance of this April 19th rally, you know, a bunch of so-called experts who are affiliated with the new government saying there's only going to be 100 people, they'll be lucky if they get 1,000, and they're planning a provocation. They're definitely planning a provocation. That's the only reason they're having this rally, is so that they can shoot someone on the street and blame the government and no. And, you know, this was the Georgian newspapers were absolutely full of this stuff. And the day passed in complete civilized, you know, quite positive atmosphere, really. And you've just got to ask, where's the blowback for every single so-called Georgian expert that was predicting blood on the streets and or only 100 people, and their predictions completely fall flat, even though they guaranteed that this would happen. And yet, yeah, you're going to find them interviewed in the next Furious Paletra or Resonancy or whatever it is, saying exactly the same stuff, and continue to be interviewed by Georgian journalists, even though they clearly know nothing.
Well, that's the Birzhoviki bias, you know, that if you say, so the person who says, like, I think it'll probably be okay, you know, nobody really cares, you know, whereas if you predict blood on the streets, you know, then it gets a little
bit more. But every time, I mean, you think their credibility would take a hit.
We'd love, anybody knows any of those articles and would like to post some of them so that we can throw them back in the faces of the expertebi who, you know, we'd appreciate that. I mean, that's wrong. I think, look, with the 10% and the 10,000, I mean, I think what that says is there are many who feel in Otsneba, and maybe not a majority, but there are many people in the Otsneba leadership that feel like everyone who supports the national movement is corrupt and wrong and a bad Georgian and a jerk. And that's not true. That there's a large and powerful constituency, and not just, I mean, you can't really do the cross tabs because of the sample size on the NDI data, but I'd be interested to know where are these. You know, poor rural peasants who didn't have their hectare, you know, gifted, you know, expropriated, they were saying our stronghold is Samagrello, which, you know, actually
there's some truth in that. I think
I don't believe there's truth in that, and I think they had the lowest regional turnout in the elections, and I think that a lot of it was that the people were, you know, quite threatened there, and that they were just telling themselves it was their stronghold. But you know, I don't know. Maybe, you know, maybe I'm wrong. It'd be interesting to know. Or, and I suspect, and I think this is quite important, that there's a lot of, you know, extremely educated people in Tbilisi and throughout the country that sort of like the project of modernization and westernization and whatever else. And so, you know, that's not a bad base to build on.
I think it's a big mix, actually. I think it's a big mix. And I think you saw that at the rally. And, I mean, yeah, you know, that's actually one of the problems of that the national movement will face, going from a party of power and a party of super dominance. Actually finding a specific and coherent constituency could prove a little bit challenging for it. And I wonder where they're going to turn. I mean, you know,
I mean, it's this message of economic, you know, neoliberal freedom.
Let's face
whatever.
That doesn't turn on more than like 1% of the population.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and so, I mean, nothing wrong with it. I understand, and I know that's sort of dear to their hearts, even though they sort of ran the country like, you know, the Chinese Communist Party in a lot of ways. But, you know, what's the, you know, where will that lead? And it'll be interesting to watch the policy side of that as well as the personnel. Yesterday, the Russian magazine Izvestia reported that one of the Boston bombers, Tamerlan Tsarnaev, was trained at sessions conducted by the Georgian Special Services and aided by Americans. According to the magazine, they got hold of documents from the Counterintelligence Department of the Georgian Ministry of Internal Affairs, which proved that the Georgian Caucasian Foundation, in cooperation with the American Jamestown Foundation, worked on winning over the North Caucasians to benefit U.S. and Georgian interests. Later, Caucasian Foundation denies this accusation and added that Tsarnaev has never been to Georgia. This is of complete, you know,
it's absurd.
Complete malarkey. But still, you know, I wanted to sort of, you know,
I mean,
note that
neocons
this is now being
of the James, these like neocon professors of the Jamestown Foundation who like write these silly articles, like the idea that they're training Chechen terrorists. I mean, again, I mean, just look at them.
Look at Vlad. I mean, can anyone imagine that guy trotting around the you know, the mountains? But you know, that's look, there's going to be a lot of this. I mean, you know, there's somebody from Chechnya, there's you know, that means that one way or another somebody in you know, in Russia is going to say that, well of course, you know, that
I mean, I think it's actually it's weird backhanded compliment to Georgia that the Russians bother even making this stuff up, you know, saying that like this country of 4 million people in like this tiny, tiny little country of 4 million people is this like massive threat and is training these people to spread terror all over the world. I mean, this is, you know, I mean, Georgia's a great place and it's got a lot going for it, but it's not a sort of global security threat in any sense of the imagination. The fact that Russia like makes it out to be that, I mean, I don't know, it's sort of
unlike,
weird pat on the back.
Unlike the 37 people in South Ossetia, which is truly a global security. BI scolded Georgian Dream MP Koba Davutashvili after Davutashvili criticized Health Minister Dato Sergenenko. Davutashvili accused him of lobbying on behalf of insurance companies and being involved in a corruption scheme. Sergenenko demands a public apology from Davutashvili. By the way, the National Bank has now been tasked with setting up oversight functions for insurance companies, which seems like a very good idea, since oversight of insurance is not been quite what it could have been over the past several years.
I mean, Davutashvili's parliamentary career is turning into something quite interesting, isn't it? You know, just like coming out with laws about condoms, complaining that no one ever takes him seriously, and then calling out the minister in his own government of being a lobbyist for insurance companies. I mean, if he wasn't such a sort of doofus, I'd quite like him.
Well, it's not, you know, it's nice that, you know, that there can be some, you know, that
dissent
that,
in the ranks.
Yeah, there can be some dissent in the ranks, and it can be public, and you know, and whatever. Coming from Koba, I'm not really sure what you know, what that means. I want him to get together with Shalvin Atalashvili. I mean, one way or another, that seems like a match made in heaven.
I mean, they've got a lot of time for each other's views. It would seem to me, yeah.
Andro Barnovi was appointed head of the presidential administration, replacing Dato
Tkeshelashvili.
Right. Prior to this appointment, Barnovi was a governor of Shidikartli region. Zura Chkheidze is now acting governor of Shidikartli. He was also, Barnovi before that was, I don't know, head of the, he was deputy
defense minister
and head of
he was
the,
an expert, a sort of defense expert, wasn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, and he was head of the military academy for quite a while. Ministry of Interior arrested the editor of the political department of Liberali magazine, Irakli Absanze. He was charged with keeping, buying, and transporting drugs and faces a sentence up to 11 years. The editorial staff of the magazine released a statement saying that Absanze received a parcel from a friend in France. The police reportedly searched the parcel and found marijuana.
But then they released him.
Yes, evidently. On bail, I guess? Or,
I mean, I don't know. Well, according to Shirena Shabdelishvili, who is the editor-in-chief of Liberali, according to Facebook status update yesterday, he's been released, you know, happy day, etc., etc. So, don't know if the charges were dropped, but it looks like he's not in so much trouble anymore.
Speaking of which, this coming Sunday, April 28th, sadly we don't have a time. If we find one, we'll put it on the forum. Marijuana legalization campaigners plan to gather supporters in Tbilisi. They call on all marijuana legalization supporters to come in front of the Parliament building on Rustaveli Avenue. The Georgia branch of Normal finally congeals.
Well, if that's I wonder if if all the stoners in Georgia can be bothered to turn out for the rally. But you see Guy Hugo Lava, mayor of Tbilisi's statement on this the other day,
right.
Where he said, "Yeah, I think I smoked weed when I was young. Yeah, I think it should be legal." I mean, it does seem like there's a bit of a groundswell of support for at least liberalising the drugs laws in this country. Decriminalisation is a huge step for a country like Georgia to take, but it does certainly seem that there is a bit of a backlash against this sort of 17 years for a single joint sentencing that goes on.
From what I know that Gigi Zettatelli, who is head of the Health Committee in Parliament, had talked about that and having sort of, you know, level A, B, C or something like that. And I also heard that it was Vano who was the one that was the gateway drug theorist and said that, you know, everything has to be illegal. So that would be something to consider. Certainly influence the tourist trade to some degree. Last Wednesday, Deputy Foreign Minister of Georgia and Israel, Dato Jalagania and Zev Elkin, signed an agreement in Jerusalem under which Georgian holders of diplomatic and service passports do not need visas to travel to Israel. On Saturday, the Justice Ministry released a video explaining the new identification cards. According to the video, biometric ID cards for Georgian citizens are not satanic. So they got that going for them. As a young man
or
in
not.
The video. Right. Of course they would.
Pretty
say
ordinary. I'd rather have a satanic card. Do I have my ID card? Can summon the power of Beelzebub? I'd much rather have that.
As a young man in the video explains, quote, "The assumption that the new ID card is the seal of the Antichrist and that it contains the sign of the beast is not correct," end quote. It continues, quote, "Georgia's public registry took upon itself a commitment not to place the number 6 three times in a row on any of the IDs, nor will it in the future," end quote. On Monday, priests and a group of Orthodox citizens protested the new electronic ID cards outside the Justice Ministry. The organizers demanded that the ministry accept alternative identity cards for those unwilling to have the biometric ID. Protesters have collected 30,000 signatures for alternative cards. Wow. So just to remind you, you know, that where we are, you know, for those who, you know, forget and think that we're, you know, hanging out in Western Europe. So
did you see the explanations that some of the protesters were giving? There was a woman quoted by George Lomsadze in Tomato Tales on Eurasianet. A woman was like, "Yeah, the monks have looked at it under a microscope and they can see a beast with horns and goat hooves when they look at the cards." The monks have looked at it under a microscope? I mean, really?
You know,
didn't their beard get in the way?
In the monks' biology lab.
So there is a genuine debate about this, which I've heard a couple of times since the video was released. Is it a good thing that the Justice Ministry addresses this at all? Is it not pandering to the sort of ridiculous, completely mad religious zealots to even admit that this is an issue and to even release that video? Or is it a nice way of like trying to reassure otherwise crazy people? There does appear to be a bit of disagreement. I'm not sure where I stand. So
yeah, I'm not either. I'm undecided on this. I mean, I do think that you're opening up quite a can of worms. I mean, you know, what that means
what
is
next?
You know, and so
textbooks, you can imagine school uniforms,
right? I mean, God, this place could end up like Texas. You know, so I mean, there are real dangers in trying to, you know, play nicely in the sandbox related to this. On the other hand, there seem to be a number of people who are worried about this. I generally, you know, if I've got to fall on one side, I would say, look, you know, if you say you need to get a biometric ID in order to do stuff, that's fine. But the fact of the matter is that the, you know, the least educated quarter of Georgian society they don't necessarily need an ID card that much. I mean, they're essentially subsistence farmers, you know, that live out in the middle of nowhere and don't, I mean, you can't, it's difficult coercively to force them to get an ID. I remember talking to Ade Shili about that and just saying that, look, there's just a heck of a lot of, you know, older people in this country that you just, it's very, very administratively difficult to get an ID card in their hands. So, I don't know, difficult question, one for which there are no quick or easy answers. Leila Kignadze, wife of Tbilisi Mayor Gihu Lava, had her driver's license revoked for a year. Patrol police pulled her over and found that she had been having some cocktails. This is the second time she's been pulled over for the offense. On Tuesday, the majority of bookstores in Tbilisi closed in protest of the education ministry's decision to give books to students for free, which publishers say will hurt the publishing business.
As someone in the publishing business, albeit the publishing not-for-profit business, what do you think about that?
Well, I'm sympathetic to the education ministry's decision because, frankly, textbooks, particularly in the last two, have always been a corrupt and sort of messy business, particularly in the last 3 years or so. There were real problems. One of them had to do with the fact that the textbooks were bad. There were lots of them. Who uses which? The distribution was quite complicated. They were expensive. There was a very high markup at the bookstore, so they were quite profitable for the bookstores. There are certainly credible rumors that they were quite profitable for senior-level personnel within the education ministry. The whole thing was just a mess, and so I think the decision to just say, okay, you know, for a year or two, we're just going to give them out free and then retreat and regroup. I'm sympathetic to that. I mean, the real reason that the bookstores don't like it is just because they had such a high markup on those specific books compared with regular retail books. But, you know, what really should happen, in my view, is that the education ministry ought to say, you know, provide guidelines and say that books that will be designated by the education ministry should be under Creative Commons licensing or you know, the sort of the intellectual equivalent of open source, mm-hmm. so that anybody can reprint them, and so that if there's a particular...
Or photocopy them
or do whatever, and so that if any, you know, if anybody, any particular publisher is charging too much for them, you can just get them online, or you can, you know, do whatever you want to get them. Somebody else can print them more cheaply. It's a solution that a lot of places are moving to now, and really does lower the cost significantly. On Monday, the Disease Control Center of the Ministry of Health began measles immunizations throughout the country. Interpress News reported last week...
Is that the same one that Jeffrey Silverman says makes black plague?
the American Bubonic Plague Center? I don't know.
From the American people.
Right, with the two hands. Yeah, I don't know. I don't think so. No, they don't do immunization there. This is just like some regular immunization.
Right.
You know, Interpress News reported last week that the number of cases of measles has increased to 475. The U.S. Embassy keeps sending out text messages and emails about this, so make sure you had your measles shot. Last year, there were only 31 cases of measles. Two people have died since February. In Tbilisi, the number of reported cases in January and February was 90. Fly Georgia will have regular flights between Tbilisi and Brussels beginning May 6th. One-way ticket will start from around 122 euros, which is a pretty good deal. Return flight is 200 euros. Pegasus Airlines added Barcelona to its list of destinations. Regular Tbilisi-Istanbul-Barcelona flights will begin May 16th. Round-trip tickets start from 246 euros. So, yeah, Fly Georgia and Pegasus are really going crazy. I don't know who owns Pegasus, but it's a sort of real competitor.
It's a Turkish
Ryanair, but they have their own airport, you know, so if you take a Pegasus flight, you can't very easily transfer to Atatürk, the other airport. But they've got, you know, really, really good connections in Europe, and it's really pulling down the prices. And then Fly Georgia, which is an Iranian-owned airline, is also got some really great deals going. So, parliamentary news. Misha vetoed two bills. The first is a change to the law on general courts, which eliminates the powers of the Council of Justice, as we discussed. The second is a change to the law on the jury, which would make it so prosecutors, rather than the defendant, gets to decide whether there will be a jury trial. Experts have brought a new draft law on agricultural land ownership to the parliament. The law would impose restrictions on land purchased by foreigners. The draft restricts foreigners who wish to acquire more than 2.5 hectares of land. According to the draft, only a total of 5% of agricultural lands can be owned by foreigners. In case of a legal person, meaning a company, the land can be purchased only if a Georgian citizen is holder of 51% of the company. A foreigner who wants to acquire agricultural land in Georgia should live legally in the country for at least 10 years, and now my favorite part, should have agricultural education.
This strikes me as a bad law.
This is unbelievably bad and stupid. It's really
pandering, you know, to the people that don't like the Sikhs, isn't it? Basically.
Well, who knows who it's pandering to? But I mean, it could have, you know, pretty serious consequences. And the
what's going to happen to Ferrero in Samogredo that own huge swaths of hazelnut plantations? They're not Georgian citizens, are they? They're Italian.
Who knows? I mean, there's. What this means is it will keep the prices of agricultural land very, very low. And what happens is an overwhelming majority of what could be seriously tilled land in the country is now just sort of vague pasturage used by neighbors. It's not a good thing. I mean, what's interesting is how this got to Parliament. I would be very, very surprised if the agricultural minister
We've seen protests in villages against Indians planting orchards and stuff like that. You know, there's been a wave of Punjabi farmers coming here to use their expertise in tilling Georgia's fertile soils, and you've had a few protests, villages stopping them from moving in, but blocking roads with tractors and so on. And this law comes hot on the heels off that, and that's genuinely a worrying development because, Georgian agriculture needs revitalization. That was one of Bidzina's big, big promises in advance of the election, and this just doesn't strike me as the way to do it.
I mean,
preventing investment in the field that
this remember, this came from experts, all right, which means it may have been introduced by, you know, some random yahoo on the agriculture committee, and that Otsneva faction or none of the other factions have any intention of actually voting for it. It may get tied up in committee or whatever else, but you know, the fact that it could end up there is worth taking a look at. About this question on juries, I'm not a big fan under current circumstances of Misha wielding the veto, and as discussed, I disagree with the veto of the changes on the law in general courts. But on the jury, the idea of a prosecutor deciding when a jury is used is a little bit ridiculous. I mean, the point of a jury is that the defendant has the right to say, I don't trust the courts, I'd like to take it to my peers. But I'm wondering if you have a reversal here, that if there are going to be a lot of officials that are going to be tried, that Otsneva is okay with juries doing that, because then somehow the conviction will seem more legitimate, whatever it ends up being.
And also there's a perception that the courts are loyal to the form government, and this will then avoid that.
Exactly. So because it could be that any officials would then say, okay, I would want they may be able to choose based on that. It could be quite a complicated question, but it's interesting. You know, this takes some political capital to pass this and push it through, and I think it's a bad mistake.
I think
it's a little dangerous.
I think it's a bad mistake is jury trials is, in my opinion, a very good idea for Georgia. It's also a really difficult sell. Building this sort of culture of jury trials is not going to be easy. It's not going to be easy to get people to accept it. It's not going to be able to get people to take part in it. And I just think having prosecutors force jury trials onto people is a really bad way of doing this. Very sensitive and very necessary reform, and this is not the way to go about it.
Yeah, agreed. So this week's meme is from feradi.info. That's feradi.info. Historic photographs of buildings in Tbilisi superimposed over contemporary pictures of those same places. You scroll through the photos of the buildings, like Tbilisi City Hall, the Opera House, see how they looked in the 19th century. You'll also be able to see a number of buildings that no longer exist, like the Military Temple, where Parliament is today, church on the west side of the building that's now the Café Gallery. Go to feradi.info and look for Speaking Stones. We'll post the link on our site. It is very, very cool. Really well done. Hats off to Jumpstart for this. I really recommend everyone take a look at it. Not really a meme, but as mentioned before, everyone take a look at Dima Shashkin's Facebook page. I mean, it's really like, portraying himself as sort of MacArthur, you know, in camo doing push-ups and, you know, and stuff like that. I saw several different pictures of him posted on
George C. Scott's pattern.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. that kind of thing. You know, make the other son of a, you know, die for his country kind of stuff. It's really, I mean, he's not defense minister anymore. So what's the
connection? He was kind of like a sort of, you know, pudgy guy with a background in NGO work. It's not like he's Rambo.
I don't know. I always worry when I see, you know, politicians who've sort of fallen out, getting in fatigues, and yeah. Also, we don't really cover Azerbaijan, but if you do, there's something you ought to take a look at. New independent TV station, I think just on the internet for now, but interesting people behind it and could end up being quite important. Look at Meydan-TV.com. That's Meydan-TV.com. Interesting development there. This week's geocapital number is 1.9%, which is Georgia's annual military expenditure as a percentage of GDP, according to the 2010 World Factbook estimate. Compared to Georgia's neighbors, this is relatively low. Azerbaijan spends 2.6% of the country's GDP on its military, while this number is 2.8% in Armenia, 3.9% in Russia, and a whopping 5.3% in Turkey.
I believe the NATO guideline is 4%.
Really?
Yeah. And most countries don't do it.
That's too much.
I might be wrong about that, but I believe it's 4%.
The biggest military spenders are in the Middle East, with some countries spending more than 10% of their GDP, while in the West, the United States spends 4.6% of its GDP on the military. It would be doing the entire world a giant favor if it would cut that in half. Compared to only 1.5% for Germany and 2.5% for the United Kingdom. Two countries spend nothing. Malta,
Costa Rica,
and Iceland.
What about Costa Rica? Doesn't have an army.
I don't know. You know, then they have that sort of police-y army.
They have a police force.
You know? I don't know. Yeah. This week's English language movies at Rustaveli Movie Theater across from Parliament are on Saturday the 27th, The Croods at 5 p.m., Lari 50 Tetri. In addition, Sundance award-winning Georgian documentary, The Machine Which Makes Everything Disappear, by Tinatin Gurciani, will be playing every day at Rustaveli Cinema at noon, 2 p.m., 11:30 p.m., until May 11th. It will be shown with English subtitles. Everybody go see this. I have not seen it, but I saw a preview, and it looks really, really cool. So that is Rustaveli Cinema right across from the Tbilisi Parliament, noon, 2 p.m. and 11:30 p.m. Every single day. Kolga movies this week are tomorrow, Friday, To Rome with Love, 2012. Saturday, April 27th, Tragedy of a Ridiculous Man, 1981. Sunday, April 28th, Me and You, from 2012. All movies start at 8 p.m. at Dom Kino, across from Rustaveli Metro and McDonald's. Tickets are 7 lati. Tbilisi Municipality is organizing free concerts in Tbilisi Parks on Saturdays starting on April 27th. First concert will be held at Mushtaidi Park on the 27th. Second is in Alexandrovna Park on May 11th. Rije on the 18th. Deda Ana Park on the 25th. Guldani Park on June 1st. Vera Park on June 8th. Mziuri, June 15th, and Tatsminda Park on June 23rd. All concerts will begin at 3 p.m. No information on who's actually playing. Maybe different people. What is Tatsminda Park? What is
that? That's where the fun fair is.
Oh, up on the hill. Ah, okay, got it. That's it for this week. My Twitter address is at TXTBUK. Our email is tbilpod@gmail.com or post to the forum on our website, www.tbilpod.com. And this week, we will finish with the Bacow Rhythm and Steel Band, PIMP, from 2003.